Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Yale Law Professor Amy Chua gives her inaugural lecture as the John M. Duff Professor of Law. Professor Chua, an expert on international business and globalization, gives a historical overview of former world dominant powers and discusses the possibility and desirability of an American empire.
Thank you so much, Harold, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. I, too, would like to express my gratitude to John and Victoria Duff for their tremendous generosity and friendship to the school, and to say how honored I am to be the first holder of the Duff Chair. I hope I can do it justice. I'm also delighted to have my parents, my sister Cynthia, some friends who have come a long way, my daughter Sophia and Louisa, and also my husband Jed Rubenfeld, whom I believe some of you have met. What I'd like to do for the next 50 minutes or so is to basically lay out the thesis of my forthcoming book with its narrow, modest subtitle, How the Greatest Powers in the History of Mankind Rose to Global Dominance and Why They Fell. So I'll set forth my thesis, and then I'll try to illustrate it with examples from the Achaemenid Persian Empire founded in 550 BC to the Great Mongol Empire of the 13th century to the British Empire. I'll then return to the present day and say something about the implications of my thesis for the 21st century, specifically addressing the debate about the possibility and the desirability of an American empire. And then I'll open things up for questions. So let me begin by saying that my thesis specifically concerns hyperpowers, not just great powers, not even superpowers, but hyperpowers. Many people have written about empires, both ancient and modern, but to date, no one has systematically analyzed this far rarer phenomenon that is the remarkably few societies, and there really have been barely more than a handful throughout history, that amassed such extraordinary economic and military might that they became what could be called a global hegemon or a world dominant power. Who were history's past hyperpowers, and what can they teach us about our own times? It took me over 5 years and lots of great research assistants in this room to reach my own answers to these questions. And what I've found is a remarkable, I think, unvarying pattern, and that is that for all their enormous differences, every single hyperpower in history, that is, every society that could even arguably be described as having achieved global hegemony, was, at least by the standards of its time, strikingly pluralistic and tolerant during its rise to preeminence. Indeed, in every case, tolerance was indispensable to the achievement of hegemony. Conversely, the decline of hyperpowers has repeatedly coincided with intolerance, xenophobia, and calls for a religious or ethnic purity. But here's the catch. It was also too much tolerance, in a sense, that sowed the seeds of decline. Now, I know those are big claims, so let me just first clarify some of the terms that I'm using. One of the biggest challenges I faced in working on this project was how to define a world-dominant power, especially given that the world was so much larger 2,000 or even 500 years ago, before ships, planes, technology drastically shrank it. So Rome, in its heyday, for example, was clearly a world-dominant power. If Rome wasn't, then no one was. Even though halfway across the globe, there existed another great empire, Han Dynasty China, with which Rome had virtually no contact. But if the point is that Rome was dominant in the world it knew and inhabited, then weren't the Aztecs dominant in their world, the Egyptians in theirs? Isn't Tahiti a hyperpower in its own little world? Well, any definition that includes Tahiti as a global hegemon is clearly too broad. But what is the right definition? What exactly differentiates Rome from, say, the Aztecs, who at one point dominated Central America, but who could never have been considered a world hegemon? Well, several factors are obvious. One is the sheer size of the Roman Empire. It's the immense population it ruled, an estimated 60 to 120 million, as compared to an estimated 1 to 6 million for the Aztecs. And the fact that no power on earth was economically or militarily superior to Rome during the High Empire. In short, Rome did not merely achieve dominance in its world, it achieved dominance in the world. Accordingly, for my purposes, I will consider a nation or empire a world-dominant power, that is a hyperpower, I'll use these terms interchangeably, only if it satisfies all three of the following conditions. One, its power clearly surpasses all of its known contemporaneous rivals. Two, it is not clearly inferior in economic or military strength to any other planet power on the planet, known to it or not. And three, it projects its power over so immense an area of the globe and over so immense a population that it breaks the bounds of mere local or even regional preeminence. Under this definition, Louis XIV's France was not a world dominant power. Neither was the Habsburg Empire or the United States during the Cold War. Each of these great powers failed condition one, that is, they each had formidable rivals of roughly comparable might. Now, in a moment, I'll tell you which societies I think do qualify as hyperpowers, but let me first say something about why tolerance is so vital to world dominance. At first, this claim might seem surprising, but in fact, there's a simple, very intuitive explanation. To be world dominant, not just regionally or locally dominant, but world dominant, a society has to be at the forefront of the world's technological, military, and economic development. And at any given historical moment, the most valuable human capital the world has to offer, whether in the form of intelligence, physical strength, skill, knowledge, networks, creativity, is never going to be found in any one location or within any one ethnic or religious group. So to pull away from its rivals on a global scale, a society must pull into itself and motivate the world's best and brightest, regardless of ethnicity, religion, or background. This is what every hyperpower in history has done, and the way they've done it is through tolerance. Now, some of you must be thinking, wait a second, the Mongols were tolerant? Genghis Khan's ravaging hordes, who slaughtered entire villages, then used the corpses as moat fill, who poured molten silver into the eyes and ears of their enemies? Can the Mongols or the British Empire, with its colonialism and white man's burden, really be described as tolerant? Well, yes, but that's because the kind of tolerance that I'm talking about is not tolerance in the modern human rights sense. By tolerance, I don't mean political or economic or cultural equality, or even respect. Rather, as I will use the term, tolerance simply means letting very different kinds of people live, work, and prosper in your society, even if only for instrumental or strategic reasons. To be a little more formal, I will use tolerance to refer to the degree of freedom with which individuals or groups of different ethnic, religious, racial, linguistic, or other backgrounds are permitted to coexist, participate, and rise in society. Note then that tolerance, as I'm using it, is a relative concept. What matters is not whether a society is tolerant according to some absolute standard, but whether it is more tolerant than other contemporaneous societies. So, for example, Jews in the late 19th century found the United States a haven by comparison to the pogroms they were fleeing, but were still subjected to anti-Semitism in the United States. One last clarification to avoid any misunderstanding. My thesis is not that more tolerance always leads to more prosperity, nor am I arguing that tolerance is necessary for prosperity. Sadly, plenty of brutally intolerant societies have become rich and powerful. Nazi Germany is a case in point. Rather, my thesis, and this goes back to the hyperpowers, is simply that tolerance is necessary for world dominance. Throughout history, no society based on racial purity, religious zealotry, or ethnic cleansing has ever achieved world dominance. To attain and maintain dominance on a global scale, coercion is simply too inefficient, persecution too costly, and ethnic or religious homogeneity, like inbreeding, too unproductive. Let me turn now to some concrete examples, beginning with the hyperpowers of antiquity. Basically, in ancient times, tolerance was the only way to build the largest, most powerful military. So if you limit your army to, say, only pure-blooded Spartans, it's only going to be so big. It may be bigger than 300, but it's only going to be so big. By contrast, if you open up your military to warriors of any race or background, you can amass a really huge army. The world is your limit. And this is exactly what the Persians did. Founded in 550 BC by Cyrus the Great, Achaemenid Persia was history's first hyperpower. In terms of size, it dwarfed and, in fact, conquered and annexed the great kingdoms of Assyria, Babylonia, and Egypt, as well as the Greek city-states. Now, it's a shame I don't have time to describe Achaemenid Persia in detail, but I will just tell you about one point. The word paradise is Persian in origin. In its Greek form, the word referred to the fabulous royal pleasure gardens of the Achaemenid kings, famous throughout the ancient world. Their riches, it was said, included every tree bearing every fruit known to man and exotic animals from the furthest reaches of an empire covering over 2 million square miles. There were Parthian camels, Armenian horses, Cappadocian mules, Nubian giraffes, Indian elephants, Lydian ibex, Babylonian buffalo, and wild beasts from throughout the kingdom. The Achaemenid paradises were a living metaphor for the empire as a whole, which at its peak ruled as many as 42 million people, nearly a third of the world's population. How could a relatively small number of Persians conquer and govern so vast a territory and population? Through tolerance. In contrast to rival kings who desecrated the local cults of conquered peoples and sought to impose their own deities on their subjects, Cyrus the Great was famous for his willingness to let conquered peoples worship their own gods and follow their own laws and customs. His policy upon conquest was essentially to replace the existing king with a Persian governor or satrap, but below the satrap to allow local elites to retain their positions of authority, interfering very little with the daily lives of his conquered subjects. These policies of tolerance, strategic tolerance, were continued by Cyrus's successors right through to perhaps the greatest Achaemenid king, Darius I. Now, in addition to making conquered peoples more compliant, the most crucial benefit the Achaemenid kings derived through this kind of tolerance was that it allowed them to build the largest war machine yet known to man. Just as the Achaemenid paradises held flora and fauna from every corner of the empire, so too the Achaemenid army was a colossal multinational force, drawing its strength from Greek mercenaries, Phoenician sailors, Libyan charioteers, and hundreds of thousands of foot soldiers from Ethiopia, Bactria, Sogdiana, and elsewhere in the empire. But Achaemenid's legendary tolerance, according to most sources at least, was not followed by Darius' son Xerxes, whose brutality and intolerance are usually said to have sparked resistance and rebellion throughout the empire, triggering its decline and eventual disintegration. Now, in fact, it's actually hard to know whether Xerxes' intolerance actually led to the decline or whether his decline was just a response to a decline that had already begun. Most likely, both propositions are true. In any event, after the fall of the Achaemenid Empire around 330 BC, the world did not see another hyperpower for another 400 years until Rome's High Empire in the 2nd century AD. As with the Persians, ethnic and religious tolerance was indispensable to Rome's rise to hegemony. It was only through tolerance that Rome was able to build its massive, unrivaled military and to enlist into the service of the empire the most valuable human capital in the Western world. To quote Gibbon, whereas the Greek fixation on preserving, quote, the pure blood of the ancient citizens had checked the fortune and hastened the ruin of Athens and Sparta, the genius of Rome deemed it more prudent, as well as honorable, to adopt virtue and merit for her own wheresoever they were found, among slaves or strangers, enemies or barbarians. Indeed, Rome far exceeded Achaemenid Persia in its tolerance. Whereas all the Achaemenid Persian kings and virtually all of its governors were Persians, there was no ethnic ceiling in Rome. The Romans permitted educated men of any race or nationality to rise to the very highest positions of authority, including even the position of emperor itself. Trajan was the first Roman emperor of non-Italian stock. He was born in Spain. Trajan's top consuls included a Greek, an Israeli, and a Moor. Hadrian also hailed from Spain. The emperor Septimius Severus was a North African married to a Syrian. Now, this might be a good place for me to repeat that when I say tolerance, I am not talking about equality or respect for human rights. Roman women, for example, were almost entirely excluded from public life and were not allowed to vote, hold office, or wear the toga. Moreover, the Romans kept slaves, thousands of whom were shredded by wild beasts at the gladiator games before cheering crowds. So many victims were gutted, skewered, or torn open that doctors used to attend the games in order to study anatomy. But perhaps the most intriguing aspect of the Roman Empire was the attraction that foreign peoples felt toward it. Conquered subjects from Britannia to Syria wanted to be part of it, to be Roman. conquered peoples went on, often within one or two generations, to don Roman togas, build Roman towns and amphitheaters, and embrace Roman values and culture. Local elites from Africa to Scotland all spoke fluent Greek and Latin and sent their children to schools in Rome. Those children grew up to be full members of the Roman community. A crucial piece of this Romanization of peoples across the empire was the enticement of citizenship, a coveted status Rome bestowed on men throughout the empire. The legal rights, the rights entailed by citizenship, changed over time, but in general they included the right to vote, the right to hold property and make contracts, freedom from torture, immunity from death penalty unless convicted of treason, and equal protection under Roman law. Moreover, citizenship was not limited only to the upper classes. Commoners could become citizens too by serving in the military for 25 years, and hundreds of thousands did so. For centuries, Rome's colorblind and surprisingly class-blind approach to citizenship helped hold the empire together, fostering loyalty and creating a common political identity that expanded to the edge of the known world. Rome lasted longer than any other hyperpower in history, but it too eventually fell. And among the many much debated causes of Rome's fall, one of the most important was surely Rome's sharp turn to intolerance, both religious and ethnic. In 312 AD, for reasons still opaque, the Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity. And the Roman Empire, so long famed for its religious openness, embarked on an intensifying wave of persecutions. As Montesquieu later wrote, "Unlike the ancient Romans that fortified their empire by tolerating every cult, their successors reduced the empire to nothing by cutting out one after another all the sects incompatible with the dominant one." At the same time, Rome's ethnic tolerance was pushed beyond its breaking point by the influx of massive populations of Germanic barbarians from the north. The Romans were frightened and disgusted by these Vandals, Goths, and other Germans, repelled by their smell and by the rancid butter they smeared in their yellow hair. For the first time, Rome adopted apartheid policies, barring intermarriage and segregating the Germanic peoples, who were subjected to growing hostility, violence, and even massacres. The Germans reacted with a vengeance. In the 5th century, Germanic tribes sacked Rome, overran Gaul, took Carthage in North Africa, and sacked Rome again. By 476, the Western Roman Empire was no more. Now, in my book, I discuss two other pre-modern hyperpowers, Tang Dynasty China and the Great Mongol Empire. And for lack of time, let me just talk very briefly about the latter, which for me, I think is really the most fascinating case. The Mongols were a nomadic people. Even their leaders, or khans, were illiterate. They had no science, no engineering, no written language of their own. They had no agriculture or architecture, living in yurts or tents made from the felt of yaks. They did not even have the technology to bake bread. Yet the Mongols came to rule over an empire far larger than the Romans ever conquered, half the known world, including the most magnificent cities of the time: Baghdad, Bukhara, Kiev, Moscow, Damascus, and Samarkand. How did the Mongols do this? Again, through tolerance. First, Genghis Khan, the founder of the empire, deliberately and quite ingeniously overcame the clan and tribal animosities that had divided the people of the Mongolian steppe for hundreds of years, uniting them under a single identity, the people of the felt walls. In this way, he put together an inter-ethnic army large enough to conquer northern China. From there, Genghis Khan shrewdly recruited men from conquered populations with the skills and technological expertise that the Mongols themselves lacked. Most critically, Genghis Khan drew into his service large numbers of Chinese engineers who knew how to construct powerful siege engines with portable towers, retractable ladders, and massive catapults that hurled stones and flaming liquids. It was only by incorporating foreign engineers who actually traveled with the Mongol army and often built instruments of attack right on the spot that the Mongols were able to overcome the great walled cities of Central Asia, Persia, and Eastern Europe. For all their ruthlessness in battle, the Mongols were far more religiously tolerant than any other contemporaneous power. While Christian Europe was burning heretics at the stake, Genghis Khan, himself an animist, declared religious freedom for all his subject peoples. His sons and grandsons married wives of all religious and ethnic backgrounds, and their armies included Buddhists, Muslims, and Christians of every sect. In the end, different parts of the Mongol Empire collapsed at different times, But everywhere, once again, decline was accompanied by a stark turn to ethnic and religious intolerance. By 1300, the Mongol Khans of Russia and Persia had converted to Islam, and they became increasingly fanatic in their persecution of non-Muslims. In China, the later Mongol rulers grew more and more paranoid and anti-Chinese, with one Mongol minister proposing at one point that all individuals surnamed Chang, Wang, Liu, Li, and Chao be executed. This plan, which would have eliminated 90% of China's population, was never carried out. Before it could be, the Mongols were sent fleeing back to the steppe by the new Ming Chinese rulers. So this brings me to the end of the pre-modern hyperpowers. The next society to arguably attain global dominance was, amazingly, the tiny, unlikely Dutch Republic of the 17th century. The secret to Holland's stunning success was, once again, tolerance, but now tolerance of a radically new kind. After the fall of Rome in 476 came the rise of the great religious empires, those of Christendom and Islam. Unlike the syncretic religions of antiquity, which basically assumed that different peoples would worship different gods, both Christianity and Islam insisted that there was one and only one true faith. In this sense, Christianity and Islam were inherently intolerant in a way that the ancient religions were not. Whether or not sanctioned by scripture, the result was a millennium of religious strife, bloodshed, and war. In the West, the era of religious wars slowly gave way to the Enlightenment. For the Enlightenment thinkers, tolerance was not merely instrumental. It was a moral virtue, even a duty. Persecution was not only bad strategy, it violated the freedom of conscience. Thus was born the modern ideal of tolerance, no longer merely the prerogative of calculating monarchs, but a fundamental element of the rights of man. The Enlightenment ended up both underwriting and undermining a new age of empires. On the one hand, the new toleration would make possible the first hyperpowers Europe had seen in over 1,000 years. On the other hand, with its principles of universal equality, fundamental rights, and individual liberty, the Enlightenment would make all future empires profoundly problematic. The Dutch Republic was the first European state to embrace the new tolerance. In 1579, the United Provinces of the Netherlands declared in its founding charter that each person shall remain free in his religion, and no one shall be investigated or persecuted because of his religion. Almost overnight, the Dutch Republic became a magnet for religious refugees from all over Europe. Protestants fleeing Habsburg persecution, French Huguenots, German Lutherans, Jews, Mennonites, Quakers, and pilgrims. As a direct result, between 1570 and 1670, Dutch cities exploded in population, even as other European cities were stagnating and depopulating. Of the tens of thousands of immigrants that poured in, two groups in particular were pivotal to Holland's rise. First were the Jewish bankers, merchants, and diamond traders fleeing the Spanish and Portuguese inquisitions. These men, among the richest in the world, financiers to Europe's royalty, bankrollers of armies, turned Amsterdam into the world's commercial and financial center. Second were the Protestant industrialists and artisans from Antwerp, Ghent, and Bruges, who brought with them not only wealth, but critical industrial secrets, the world's most advanced textile technology, and as Max Weber would later put it, the spirit of capitalism itself. With a decisive contribution of these two groups, the Dutch soon became the financial, technological, and commercial leaders of Europe, and in fact, the world. But even so, can it really be said that the Dutch Republic was a hyperpower, under my definition? After all, its army was not the largest in Europe, although it was the second largest and probably the most efficient and well-equipped. To focus on the size of its standing army is to misunderstand how the Dutch Republic triumphed over its rivals. The Dutch never sought to conquer the European continent. Its empire, of course, was a maritime empire, devoted more to commercial expansion than territorial expansion. By the 17th century, naval might had become the royal road to world dominance, and the Dutch took control of the seas. The extent of Dutch maritime domination is astonishing. Of the 20,000 ships involved in the world's carrying trade in the mid-17th century, approximately 16,000 were Dutch. In 1639, Dutch warships humiliated the once indomitable Spanish Navy, destroying 60 of Spain's 77 warships at a cost of just one Dutch ship. At its peak, the Dutch Navy was roughly equal to the French and English naval forces combined, a staggering fact given that France's population was 10 to 20 times larger. Controlling the oceans, the Dutch completely cornered Europe's rich trades, that is, the immensely lucrative global traffic in luxury commodities. Dutch ships traveled to distant corners of the world, carrying back East Indies pepper and spices, sugar from Brazil and San Tome, Turkish mohair, Castilian wool, Indian cotton, and raw diamonds. The Dutch then either traded these riches throughout Europe or brought them back to Holland, where the raw materials were processed and re-exported at enormous profit in the form of luxury tapestries, patterned silks, fine linens, and exquisitely cut gemstones. Between 1625 and 1675, the Dutch Republic was far and away the richest nation on earth, with by far the most upward mobility. Sons of cheesemakers lived in palaces with marble and alabaster columns. As one indignant European critic sputtered, "Mr. Everyman thinks he's entitled to wear what he likes, so long as he can pay for it. Can you bear it when you see that a tailor has a parlor hung with gold tapestry?" How did the Dutch achieve all this? Largely through immigrant investment, immigrant innovations in raising capital, immigrant manufacturing skills, technology, and trading networks. It was in this way that the Dutch attained, as Emmanuel Wallerstein has put it, undisputed productive commercial and financial superiority and the rare condition of global hegemony. Tolerance was equally essential to Great Britain, the successors to the Dutch on the world stage. For most of the 16th and 17th century, what is now Great Britain was a pit of vicious religious and ethnic warfare. Protestants massacred Catholics, Catholics beheaded Protestants, Anglicans persecuted dissenters, and Englishmen slaughtered Irish, Scots, and Welsh, all of whom retaliated in kind. There was no persecution of Jews because there were no Jews. They had been expelled in 1290. All this was to change after 1689. In that year, Parliament passed the Bill of Rights and the Act of Toleration. 20 years later, England united with Scotland and Wales, and despite continuing anti-Catholic bigotry and brutality, by the early 18th century, Great Britain had replaced the Dutch Republic in reputation as the most tolerant nation in Europe. Because of England's marked turn towards tolerance after 1689, three groups in particular, Jews, Huguenots, and most importantly, Scots, were able to enter into British society with unprecedented freedom. The benefits to Great Britain were immense and immediate. England became the new haven for Europe's Jews, who, with astonishing rapidity, founded the London Stock Exchange, brought diamond and bullion trading to Britain, and almost single-handedly made London the new financial center of the world. Meanwhile, instead of wasting resources fighting the Scots, the English accepted them as fellow Britons and put them in the service of the army. Indeed, the Scots became Great Britain's chief empire builders. They were also the driving force in Britain's Industrial Revolution. The most critical inventions of the era, the Watt steam engine, the hot blast furnace, the integrated cotton mill, were all created by Scots, who were also Britain's leading thinkers and writers. David Hume and Adam Smith were both Scots. There's a reason that no one ever talks about the English Enlightenment, but they do, of course, talk about the Scottish Enlightenment. The contributions of these previously excluded groups were absolutely pivotal to Britain's rise to world dominance. Take, for example, the Bank of England, the country's most powerful financial institution and a chief reason why Britain was able to triumph over France. A Scot conceived the bank, Huguenots funded it, and Jews brokered its biggest loans. But if Great Britain followed the Dutch formula of tolerance at home, the British Empire essentially pursued a Roman strategy abroad. How did 1,000 British civil servants govern India with its native population of over 200 million? Like the Romans, the British were masters of strategic tolerance. They enlisted, educated, and trained a large cadre of native bureaucrats and elites. They filled the ranks of the imperial army with hundreds of thousands of native soldiers, including Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs, all permitted to worship as they chose. Indeed, the British deliberately separated Indian soldiers of different regions, backgrounds, and castes into their own companies with their own uniforms. In this way, the British were able not only to honor native customs and rituals, but also to rigidify and exploit India's internal divisions, which played nicely into Britain's divide and conquer strategy. Once it achieved global dominance, Great Britain found itself in a profoundly schizophrenic position. At home, Britain triumphantly embraced the values of pluralism and tolerance. But abroad, it simply could not live up to its Enlightenment ideals. In India, Rhodesia, Jamaica, and almost all their overseas dominions, British colonizers ruled as Occidental despots, who, even as they made use of local manpower and elites, presumed white Christian superiority and openly practiced ethnic and racial discrimination. Thus, British tolerance, too, had limits it could not cross. Close to home, Britain faced this problem with Catholic Ireland. Abroad, the problem was racism. The British in India, for example, especially the expatriate business community, lived an essentially apartheid existence in militarily protected enclaves separated from the black towns where the Indians lived. Beatings, floggings, and accidental shootings of natives were common. In 1919, Brigadier General R.E.H. Dyer ordered his soldiers to open fire on 15,000 unarmed Indians who had gathered inside a walled field in the Punjab in violation of a curfew. Without warning, Dyer's brigade poured 1,600 rounds of live ammunition into the trapped crowd. The British paid dearly for such errors of judgment. We tend to forget this today, but it's amazing how loyal many Indians were to the British Empire. In the 1890s, members of the Indian National Congress cheered whenever Queen Victoria's name was mentioned. 1 million Indians served the British in the First World War. Even Gandhi, on the eve of that war, told his followers, "We are, above all, British citizens of the great British Empire. Our duty is to support the British, to fight with our life and our property." But after the war, disillusion awaited. The British did not reward the Indians with the greater political power and economic participation they expected. On the contrary, there was more brutality and repression. Now, my point is emphatically not that the British could still be colonial masters in India today had they only been more tolerant. But there were other, more visionary possibilities that went untapped. As late as 1931, when India's leaders were already committed to independence, Gandhi was asked, "How far would you cut India off from the empire?" Gandhi replied, "From the empire entirely, from the British nation, not at all. I should love to be an equal partner with Britain, sharing her joys and sorrows, but it must be a partnership on equal terms." What would have happened if Britain had forged with India the equal partnership Gandhi sought? After all, Britain had done just that with Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, its white colonies. What would the world look like today if Britain had extended the same tolerance to its dark-skinned colonies that it extended to its white dominions? It's impossible to know, but perhaps decolonization could have taken place on terms far more advantageous to both Britain and its former colonies. Instead, Great Britain fell from world-dominant empire to second-rate power, while its former non-white colonies descended into third-world pathologies. Meanwhile, another power, itself a former British colony, was rising. Of America's ascent to hyperpower status, I'm actually going to say almost nothing here. If my thesis is correct that the secret to world dominance lies in relative tolerance, that is, the ability to attract the world's best and brightest talent, then the United States, as a nation of immigrants, founded on the principle of tolerance, has always had a leg up. To be sure, while the United States has always been relatively religiously tolerant, it demonstrated extreme racial and ethnic intolerance for much of its history, most notably towards Native Americans, African Americans, and other non-whites. It was only after the Second World War, with Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Revolution, that the United States began developing, however fitfully and imperfectly, into one of the most ethnically and racially open societies in world history. Not coincidentally, this was also the period in which the United States achieved world dominance. Now, in my book, I do try to make the case that America's growth and success, from its westward expansion to its industrial explosion to the atomic bomb to Silicon Valley and its domination of the computer age, were all direct products of immigrant contributions. But I won't try to make that case here today. I'm also going to put aside the question of whether what's happened in Iraq recently might allow someone to say that America is no longer a hyperpower, or perhaps never was in the first place. As I use the term, I think that America still is a hyperpower, and I'm happy to say more about this during the Q&A. Instead, what I'd like to do with my remaining time is to turn to the question of an American empire. It was September 11th, of course, that put the talk of empire back on the table as a potentially desirable thing. A month after the World Trade Center attacks, a much-quoted essay appeared in the Weekly Standard entitled "The Case for American Empire," arguing that the most realistic response to terrorism is for America to embrace its imperial role. A year later, the White House issued a new national security strategy, emphasizing the essential role of American military strength and declaring a commitment to maintaining American unipolar military preeminence. In 2004, economist Deepak Lal published a book called "In Praise of Empires, Warning of Dire Global Consequences If, quote, the U.S. public does not recognize the imperial burden that history has thrust upon it." At around the same time, British historian Niall Ferguson called on the United States to get over its imperial denial and take on the civilizing and modernizing mission that Great Britain had carried in centuries past. Now, what exactly do these proponents of an American empire have in mind when they use this term? Obviously, no one is calling for President Bush to be named Emperor of the Middle East, as Queen Victoria was named Empress of India. Rather, the idea of an American empire seems to refer to the aggressive, interventionist use of American military force, with or without international approval, to effect regime change and nation building. That is, to replace dictatorships, rogue states, and other threatening regimes with pro-market, pro-democracy, pro-American governments. This is a position, by the way, supported not only by the so-called neoconservatives, but also by many influential liberals, especially in the period before and immediately after the invasion of Iraq. But these calls for an American empire have all missed something crucial: history. For all the world's changes, the United States today faces the same fundamental problem confronted by every hyperpower in history. Yet, precisely because it is a modern hyperpower, the United States is especially ill-equipped to deal with this problem. Let me explain. Over the centuries, there's been an evolution in what it means and what it takes to be a hyperpower. Basically, this transformation has involved a shift from conquest to commerce, from invasion to immigration, from autocracy to democracy. For the pre-modern hyperpowers, tolerance essentially meant tolerating conquered peoples, honoring their traditions, co-opting their elites, and recruiting their best warriors and engineers. In this way, the Persians, Romans, and Mongols built the mightiest empires and war machines of their time. The Dutch Republic was the first hyperpower to break from this model, relying far more on commerce and immigration. Great Britain was in many ways Holland's successor, but it was Rome's successor too, taking up Rome's expansionist, civilizing mission. As the British learned, however, the Roman model of empire proved untenable in a democratizing world where the right of every nation to govern itself had begun to be universally recognized. The United States is, in a sense, at the end point in this evolution of hyperpowers. The United States is not only the first nation of immigrants to become a hyperpower, it is also the first mature universal suffrage democracy to do so. Indeed, democracy, like capitalism, is intimately connected with the very meaning of tolerance in the modern age. Like its relatively freewheeling market system, which has allowed untold numbers to rise economically, democracy in the United States is part of its distinctively modern brand of strategic tolerance, in principle providing Americans of any creed or skin color an equal opportunity to participate and rise in politics. As such, democracy is part of the formula that has made America the hyperpower it is. But democracy also imposes limits on America as compared to the hyperpowers of the past. Those calling for an American empire often compare the United States to Rome. This comparison is apt in many ways. Unique among the empires of antiquity, Rome offered a cultural package that was enormously appealing to far-flung, vastly different peoples, at least if they weren't slaves. Similarly, the United States today offers a cultural package: blue jeans and baseball, hip-hop and Hollywood, fast food and Frappuccino light, that is maddeningly attractive to millions, if not billions, around the world. But ancient Rome had an advantage. It could make the people it conquered and dominated part of the Roman Empire. Defeated people from Scotland to Spain to West Africa all became subjects of the greatest power on earth. Even more significantly, Rome turned large numbers of conquered men, both elites and common soldiers, into Roman citizens, clothed with the high status and privileges that such citizenship entailed. The United States can do no such thing. Precisely because it is a democracy, the United States does not try or want to make foreign populations its subjects, and certainly not its citizens. When the United States government speaks of bringing democracy to the Middle East, it is not contemplating Iraqis or Syrians voting in the next U.S. presidential elections. This, then, is America's dilemma. Inside its borders, the United States has, over time, proven uniquely successful in creating an ethnically and religiously neutral political identity capable of uniting as Americans, individuals of all backgrounds. But as a hyperpower, America is not only dominating Americans. Outside its borders, there is no political glue binding the United States to the billions of people who live under its shadow. As a result, the United States faces a problem as old as empire itself, which, for lack of a better term, I will call the problem of glue. History's first hyperpower never solved this problem. As the Achaemenid Persian Empire expanded, it came to include increasingly diverse peoples, yet the empire had no overarching political identity or glue to unite it. Only sheer military might held it together. Indeed, the same tolerance that allowed the Persians to assemble their mighty empire encouraged their subject peoples to preserve their own languages, identities, and political affiliations. Less than a century after its founding, the empire was riven by fragmentation and separatist rebellions. When a stronger, more charismatic military leader, Alexander of Macedon, swept through the region, elites throughout the empire simply switched their allegiances. They were not traitors because they had never been patriots. A similar fate befell the Mongols. Through strategic tolerance, Genghis Khan succeeded in creating a single people out of the warring tribes of the Mongolian steppe. But to put it mildly, this identity, the people of the felt walls, had no appeal beyond the steppe. With no common identity to bind together its European, Middle Eastern, and Asian conquered peoples, the Mongol world empire quickly splintered into four large kingdoms before breaking up altogether. Of all of history's hyperpowers, only Rome really solved this problem, which goes a long way toward explaining its spectacular longevity. Through its extension of citizenship to Greeks, Gauls, Africans, and Britons alike, Rome managed to Romanize vastly disparate peoples living continents apart, creating a common identity, generating loyalty among its far-flung subjects. This option is not available to the United States. As an ironic result, America's relationship to the world it dominates is actually much more like ancient Persia's than Rome's. Under Persian hegemony 2,500 years ago, a Greek felt that he was a Greek and spoke Greek. An Egyptian felt that he was an Egyptian and spoke Egyptian. And so it is today under the hegemony of the world's first democratic hyperpower. The great mistake made by those championing an American empire lies in assuming that the spread of markets, democracy, and American brands and consumer culture would be enough to Americanize the nations of the world, creating common values and even a desire for American leadership. This assumption was as naive as the belief that liberated Iraqis were going to greet American troops with sweets and flowers. Wearing a Yankees baseball cap and drinking Coca-Cola does not turn a Palestinian into an American. Today, the United States faces billions of people around the world, most of them poor, who want to be like Americans but don't want to be under America's thumb, who want to dress and live like Americans but who are denied visas by the U.S. Embassy, who are told over and over that America stands for freedom but see only the American pursuit of self-interest. For all these reasons, I think that an American empire would be deeply ill-considered, even from the point of view of America's own interests. While the United States has certainly had its imperialist moments, it is not through imperialism that America became the world's richest and strongest nation. On the contrary, the secret to America's success has always been its ability to attract and reward talented and enterprising individuals of all backgrounds, providing the United States with a continuing human capital edge that has proven equally decisive in the industrial, atomic, and computer ages. Moreover, in today's world, an aggressively militaristic hyperpower incurs massive costs, whether measured in terms of money spent, lives lost, legitimacy squandered, or hatred provoked, without any of the benefits that accrued to empires of the past. The face of an American empire is present-day Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops caught far from home in the middle of a sectarian war, disliked and targeted on all sides with no obvious upside or even concrete objective in sight. To be clear, this is not an argument for America to embrace pacifism or isolationism. Terrorism may require strong military measures, and ethnic cleansing or other crimes against humanity might also justify military intervention. The argument, rather, is against empire building, that is, the use of America's world-dominant military might abroad to unilaterally and preemptively affect regime change and remake other nations by imposing American-style institutions. To conclude, I think that the crucial question for the years and decades to come will be whether America can address this problem that I've called glue. Are there mechanisms, whether institutional or commercial, or through some marriage of constitutional and international law, through which the United States can, without losing its sovereignty, create a kind of common identity with the billions of people around the world it dominates, giving others more of a stake in America's success and leadership? Ironically, it may be that the only way that the United States can remain a hyperpower is by resisting the temptations of militarism. But if America is destined to remain a hyperpower in the decades to come, it should be a hyperpower of wealth, opportunity, and moral force, not a hyperpower of empire and military force. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions.